Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, the podcast that uncovers the greatest sounds and stories in bluegrass music, one iconic record at a time.
I'm Emma John, author, journalist, and all-round bluegrass novice.
And I'm Patrick McGonigal, fiddle player with the Lonely Heartstring Band.
Today we're going to be discussing Bela Fleck's Drive, the virtuosic instrumental record that has become a touchstone for modern acoustic music and has almost certainly influenced every bluegrass player who wants to break new ground today. Has it influenced you, Patrick?
Definitely. It was released in 1988. I was 2 years old. I did not listen to it when I was 2 years old. My grandfather, who has very good taste in music, gave me three records when I was a kid. He gave me this record, Drive, and the Bluegrass Sessions, Tales from the Acoustic Planet, Volume 2, and he also gave me Ricky Skaggs' Bluegrass Rules. And that was my introduction to bluegrass, and so I learned a bunch of stuff from those records, and I thought I knew bluegrass. And I showed up to a lesson with Matt Glazer, who was the founder of the string department at the Berklee College of Music, and an incredible fiddle educator and promoter of roots music. But I waltzed into his office in my first lesson with him, and I very proudly told him that I played bluegrass, and I played Up and Around the Bend or Down in the Swamp or something. And while he said those are great tunes, he said, you don't actually know bluegrass. That's very modern bluegrass. That's not indicative of what makes bluegrass bluegrass. And of course, he then pointed me towards Kenny Baker and you know, Chubby Wise and those guys. But anyways, this was the first record that I really got into with these instruments and totally changed my life. So I love this record. I have a very special place in my heart for it.
I don't have a story as good as that, but I was first told to listen to this record by a banjo-playing boyfriend.
There it is. It's a record of the heart.
So for those who don't know anything about Bela Fleck, do we want to just go back and explain who he is and why he's so important in the music?
Yes. So Bela Fleck, Bela Fleck came up in the 70s. He was a teenager, and as a teenager, he was already incredible. He was living in Boston and playing with a band called Tasty Licks. Great band name. And he was studying with Tony Trischka, also, who was lives in New Jersey now, but I think they were in New York at the time. And he just very quickly, by his early 20s, became the modern banjo player. So he was in Newgrass Revival with his friend Sam Bush and Courtney Johnson and John Cowan and Pat Flynn, not all at the same time, but
this was a band that was like looked rebellious, felt rebellious, felt like a whole new direction in bluegrass music.
Yeah, and was also a band that was not afraid to take very long, extended solos that just went totally crazy on bluegrass instruments. I guess you could say it's the beginning of the jamgrass scene that is now, you know, Sam Bush has remained the king of for 30 plus years. But then so Bela was making records like that with Newgrass Revival. He also had a bunch of solo records, which from the beginning always had the great players on them. You know, Sam Bush is on almost all of them, Mark O'Connor and Stuart Duncan and Jerry Douglas and Tony Rice. They're all on these records from the very beginning. Like Crossing the Tracks and Daybreak and that. But so then he makes this record in 88, which is a great kind of, as we were saying, touchstone acoustic record that is not just a great banjo player record, but doesn't sound like it's just a banjo record. The banjo doesn't play the melody every time. He passes it off to the fiddles or Jerry Douglas or Sam Bush often play the melody. And The banjo's not always mixed, super heavy. So it really comes across as a record about great compositions, great playing by everybody.
We've been lucky enough to be able to talk to Bela about this record and also to catch up with two other members of the band, Jerry Douglas and Mark Schatz, at a recent festival, the Grey Fox Festival in upstate New York.
And we pulled them away into a little trailer that was backstage and interviewed them. And they were both gracious enough to take time away from their very busy schedules to interview with us. I think Jerry Douglas went pretty much right from our interview straight onto stage.
So we've got their memories of recording this album. But more importantly, we've spoken to Bela Fleck. And it feels like that's somewhere we should start by hearing from him. Did you think Drive was going to be defining at the time or not?
I thought it was going to be a good record. I thought it was a very safe record to make, considering the records I had was making at the time. I had already made Deviation, and I was thinking of doing things that were really wild and modern. I wanted to break out and be adventurous and do, but I had never done a record with those guys, and I had played on a Tony Rice, a few tracks on his Cold on the Shoulder record with Sam and Tony and Jerry, and I think Vassar was on those tracks, and Todd Phillips. But I thought, wow, nobody's ever had a band like this has never made an instrumental record that I can think of. The way I could click in and groove with Tony and Sam as a rhythm section together, and the way Jerry played, he was always my favorite, musician. Anyway, I just had this idea that it would be a great thing to do, but it wasn't. I didn't expect it to be what it ended up being. I thought it would go well. I was excited to do it, but I sort of felt like maybe I was copping out a little bit. I wasn't really being as idealistic and wild and free and crazy as maybe, I had been trying to move in that direction. Cutting edge, that was really important to me at the time. But a lot of times that'll happen, people will do something like that. And because they're not trying to be so cutting edge, they're so in their comfort zone that they're really able to be themselves. And that's what happened. It turned into a nice nodal moment for that group of musicians where everybody got to sort of focus their energy into the tunes I had brought. And they were able to set me up real well. And it was like a nice photograph of those people in a group context playing this kind of music that hadn't existed before. So I just got lucky. I do remember we recorded the first song on the record first. It was called Whitewater. And we did a first take that was like, holy cow, it was like ridiculous. And it was one of those ones that sped up. So we were all like, it sped up a little bit. It was pretty great. Tony was like, that's pretty good, Bela. Let's put away the instruments. Time to go on. I was like, let's try it again. So we went back in and we did it again. And it was okay, but it wasn't as good. And we did 4, 5, 6, 7 takes. And I think Tony said, let's go hear that first one again. We heard the first one again. It was like, we just were all, we had it cranked up so loud, we were all like, yeah, baby. At the time, I don't remember it, being... I remember being disappointed by how it was received. It didn't get nominated for anything in the bluegrass community. I don't even think I was able to get a review in Bluegrass Unlimited for it.
Because it was too jazzy, too.
I just don't think it really. No, they were reviewing things like that other people did. For some reason, it just didn't happen. I don't know why. I just didn't really.
You just weren't on your game with your publicity that year.
Yeah, I wasn't doing any publicity. I never did any. It was just. I was just really sort of disappointed. So I'm glad that over the years it's turned out to be a lot of people's favorite thing that I've done, and it's still one of mine. I knew we had something when we started to record the first track. It was like, holy cow, this is some rollicking stuff. This is going to be amazing. ¶¶
that starts off, it's like you can hear the engines turning on of the whole thing. It's like jet engines. You can feel them like warming up, and Sam Bush, you know, starts grooving and the chop starts hitting and the banjo's pushing forward. It's a great first track.
So it is called Drive, and most of the tunes are pretty upbeat, some of them incredibly up-tempo, and the most important thing about this record is the groove and the rhythm.
As soon as you put this record on, it's like you want to be driving in a convertible down the California coast, because just you can feel this exciting energy. You just feel so good. I mean, that's what groove is. The other track on this record that I think has really amazing groove is Down in the Swamp. And it really starts with a groove that is so tangible and swampy. It's called Down in the Swamp. It is really swampy. And the tempo of it right off the bat is this perfect tempo that's not fast, it's not slow, it's not like medium tempo, it's this weird dirgey. It feels like you're trying to walk through a swamp and you're just being kind of pulled by the weight of this, you know, icky, gooey material.
I love that song because nothing changes about the melody. It's the same melody over and over again. There's no clever solos. There's no super pyrotechnics from any of the instruments. A lot of the rest of the album is so showy,
yeah,
and is all about them really kind of demonstrating just how well they know their instruments. This is a really simple tune, and it's like a simple story whose narrative is so compelling, mm-hmm, that you don't need to elaborate on it. And it's only the change in tempo and feel and dynamic and all these other things around the notes. The notes can just carry on, mm-hmm, being the same.
I think it was very inspired by Irish music, which I was really into at the time. And there was a period where I had an Irish girlfriend and I would spend a lot of time over there. And I loved the way the tunes would be just fine without any soloing. And I thought, we're always soloing. So that was my idea for that song, was let's just groove it. Let's keep it, you know, keep it slow, and let's break it down and rebuild it halfway through and pick it up. But I wasn't expecting the kind of guitar. Like the rhythm guitar playing on that track is actually spectacular, and there's a few things where Tony would bring something that you just could never have expected. That was one. I mean, the way he played rhythm on that track made the whole thing. So I hope I mixed it loud enough for you to hear it, but it made the thing happen.
Yeah.
It made the thing happen. But we were all into Irish music too, so I think it was kind of that idea of playing a bluegrass tune as if it was an Irish tune.
Yeah.
That was the idea of that, and it was something I wrote on the mandolin. So every once in a while I'll pick up an instrument, squeeze out a tune that's a little different, because if I'd written that tune on the banjo, I wouldn't have thought it was good enough to record. But since I wrote it on the mandolin, I was kind of proud of it, and it ended up being a tune a lot of people like.
So that's some fascinating insight from Bela. I mean, personally, there's loads there that I'm interested in. But I suppose the most obvious one to me, the one that I'd already thought about listening to the album, is the Celtic influence, the Irish influence that, you know, I just feel like keeps coming up, especially the third track, Up and Around the Bend, has this real kind of tug of the forelock to his to bluegrass's Celtic roots. To me, like, the fiddle drones in that almost sound like an accordion.
Mm-hmm. To me, when I hear that opening with those, the double fiddles of Mark O'Connor and Stuart Duncan playing together, the harmonies that they're playing against each other in that intro really sounds like the Illan Pipes, like the Irish Illan Pipes to me. The way that the Illan Pipes have those drones that often give that kind of sound where there's sometimes like a major second or something like that.
The fact that there are two fiddlers playing on this record at all, and that they're both brilliant, Stuart Duncan and Mark O'Connor, is really interesting and proof of the pull that Baylor had even at that stage.
For sure. Also, I think probably the indecisive nature of having to choose between Mark O'Connor and Stuart Duncan in 1988. Both of them were young and at the top of their game and playing the coolest stuff, in my opinion, that had been played on the fiddle. Just totally new and totally different. And so, of course, Baylor just gets them both.
And gets them to play together.
Gets them to play together and play off of each other. And I'm sure there was a little bit of healthy competition between the two of them. And all those guys, they were playing together all the time. And they were playing on all the same sessions. And they were jamming. And they were playing festivals. So I do feel like this record is maybe the one that captures that the most. You can hear that they're friends. You can hear that they're just having a good time and that they're really good at playing with each other. And specifically, Sam Bush, Tony Rice, and Mark Schatz as a core rhythm section is just unstoppably groovy and forward propelling with all that drive. And that's really on display on this record in an incredible way. Every track, you know, Sam Bush's chop is just undeniably fills your whole body with the need to dance, as Mark Schatz talks about.
There was a twin fiddle,
mm-hmm.
up and around the band, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, that tune had such incredible groove to it.
Yeah.
Bouncy, swingy. I remember, you know, I'm all about the groove and about, you know, putting life and movement and energy into music. And all that stuff felt really great. But I remember that kind of tempo. There's a bounce that just makes you, you know, makes you smile and makes your body moving, your feet jump up and down. So,
yeah.
And so those two guys trading licks in that, it was just in the parlance of some of those old, there's some old gospel song they call Supernal. The other thing is there's a good vibe between all of these folks. You know, we always had fun together. It was light. And of course, Tony and Sam known each other since, you know, way back, Bluegrass Alliance.
Yeah.
And so that was an old relationship. And, you know, we'd all kind of come up together in ways. I think I played on one of Jerry's early CDs. And Sam came up to Boston to play on Crossing the Tracks, which is Baylor's first solo record. Well, Bela, you know, Bela got me my first job in a bluegrass band. I ran into him at a old-time jam session in Boston back around 1976 or so. You know, I was going to school at Haverford at the time, so I was back in for the weekend, and there was this old-time jam, and there was this guy, Bela, who was, you know, this good-looking young kid. He must have been about 17 or 18 at the time, and he was, you know, he's always tried to do what was appropriate for the, you know, the situation. He wasn't playing a bunch of crazy stuff. He was playing the tunes. And, you know, trying to learn the tunes and play along and fit in with this old-time jam. And I was at a time when I was playing a good bit of mandolin and was trying to, like, improvise over fiddle tune chords. And so he and I stuck around afterwards, after we kind of cleared out, and I said, "Do you ever kind of just, you know, improvise over the chords of a fiddle tune or something?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I do that sometimes." And I can't help but think that there was a little twinkle in his eye when he said that. And so I said, "Well, let's play something." So maybe we played Soldier's Joy or something. And so we played the melody a time or two, and then he started playing that unbelievable kind of improvisational fury over this tune, and I was, oh my god. I suddenly felt very chastened.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually a Manhattanite. I grew up in New York City, but I heard the banjo at my grandparents' house in Queens on the Beverly Hillbillies TV show, and it just blew me away. And then one day a banjo showed up. Just a coincidence. My grandfather found one at a flea market and said, "Oh, I'll get this for Bela," and I came to visit him, and there it was. And I was 15. I never thought I could play a banjo. I just was in love with it, but I never thought anybody could actually play one. I didn't know how anybody could do it. So so I was never going to go out and get one.
Yeah.
But they went and got me, and then I had it, and I couldn't put it down. So I got it when I was 15. And then by the time I was 17, I got out of high school, I went straight into the professional world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your, as a New Yorker, what was your, when you moved to the South, mm-hmm. what were your first experiences of it like?
I loved it. I mean, I'd been touring already. I've been in bands that went down South, and I was always thrilled to get, I mean, even Washington, D.C. felt like the South. They had more of an accent down there, and go play the Birchmere and be part of, you know, where the Country Gentlemen used to play and Seldom Steen were still playing. And I guess maybe the Gents were still playing there too. And then occasionally I get to go even further south to Kentucky or Tennessee, play like Buddy's Barbecue in Knoxville or play the Festival of the Bluegrass in Lexington. And I had a sense that there were some things I didn't really understand about banjo music that I didn't want to be a Yankee banjo player. There was a stigma about Yankee banjo players not really knowing how to do it, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be one of those. You know, I was actually looking for all the things that were that my teacher did that I could go find things to do that he didn't do, so I could find out, so I could make my name for myself and not be an imitation of him, which I was at that time. I played very, very much like Tony Trischko, so I was trying to find a way. And I thought, well, let me go work on really becoming a Scruggsophile and a J.D. Crowophile, really. And so I moved to Kentucky partly for that reason, to play with guys that used to play with Crow, Glenn Lawson and Jimmy Goodreau. And I studied him, and I can't say it changed me into Crow, but it gave me a grounding that I didn't have in music overall. Because the thing about those guys is they have a guy like Crow and the kind of guys that he played with had tone and timing, and I mean, it's not just a blue, those aren't just bluegrass elements, they're musical elements, you know. You have drive and have feel and all these things I learned, they were the most important thing down there. Where up north it was all about the notes, what kind of cool fancy new thing could you come up with, which was great, but I already had that in my back pocket, but I didn't have the feel and the time and the tone, and that was really stressed in Kentucky. So that was like a missing piece of my musical upbringing.
When do you feel like you started to develop your own voice? I mean, you were taking in all these different influences and searching them out. When did your voice start to emerge?
I started making a concerted effort to stop sounding like Tony Trischka at a certain point. And there was a day when I was at a party with Tony, and we were playing, and someone came over to me and said, "You know, I was in the other room and I heard you guys playing and I couldn't tell which one was you and which one was Tony." And I was so proud of myself there for a little while. And then it occurred to me, yeah, but he's the guy who started all this stuff and plays all this stuff. If I sound just like him, that's not going to work for the long haul, is it? You know, and I had to get real with myself, and I had to actually divorce myself from some of the things that he did, or at least try and look at the things that he maybe didn't do. Try and find some things, and they were hard to find because he was so good. He still is. Like, what can I find? And I was like, okay, he plays a lot of Reno stuff and he plays some jazzy stuff, but he doesn't have all the scales up and down the neck like a jazz guitar player would. Maybe I should work on that. You know, maybe there's some areas where he'll delve into something, do a little something, but he hasn't gone deep in that particular area. He's gone deep in this area, so I'm not going there. That sort of thing, and actually look for the things. And then I thought about the sound. I didn't want people to go, "Oh, there's Tony. Oh, that's not Tony. That's a student, Baylor, who sounds like him." So moving to the South, buying an old banjo, like Earl's, I had a teacher who told me, if you want to be a real banjo player, you got to have a real banjo. There's a lot of snobbery around those banjos, and I was able to get a hold of a Flathead 75 from 1937. Or somewhere around then, and make that my sound, a more southern sound. And I was trying to like really be traditional on some songs and really be jazzy. I didn't have a my own full concept, really. I was just like, in fact, when I moved to Kentucky, I had a friend named Steve Cooley, who's a great banjo player, who had the record, and he said, well, it's funny. It's like, on one record, you sound like this banjo player. On another cut, you sound like another guy. And it's like you're a different guy on each track. And I've thought about that. I was like, well, I want to be the same guy on every track. I don't want it to sound like I'm just, each song is different. I want it to be a kind of music that holds up together.
Yeah.
And that took a while. That takes a while to figure that kind of stuff out.
Taylor Fleck has said that when it comes to composing music, he thinks of it like songwriting. And I think there are certain tracks on this record that, to me, where the instruments are almost like speaking. I definitely think that about The Lights of Home, which is an incredibly moving track where there's this plangent dobro solo. That just kind of like, you know, reaches into your heart and gives it a swift squeeze.
I can attest to Emma's feelings for this song because she was tearing up as we listened to it earlier today.
I can't work out what the feelings mean, but I think there's a sense of yearning in it, but there's also a sense of yearning fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Also, we have to talk about Sanctuary, because Sanctuary is, as a fiddle player, that's a moment in time. It's an interesting tune. We were just listening to, we gave the record a quick listen through before starting recording of the podcast. Sanctuary doesn't really have much of a melody. I mean, I feel like Bela really wrote a banjo tune with that one.
Yeah, you would have struggled to impress Matt Glazer with this.
Yeah, it's just a lot of banjo chords, which, you know, a lot of banjo tunes are just banjo chords, but they're cool chords, and it's fun to listen to, and everyone gets to take very expressive solos because I don't think anyone really knows what the melody is. But then Mark O'Connor kind of steps up to the plate and plays one of the most legendary fiddle solos of all time. Maybe also plays the highest notes that have ever been heard in bluegrass. And bluegrass is famous for its high notes.
It's got a really interesting backstory, as Jerry Douglas told us about. So we've managed to catch up with Jerry Douglas at Grey Fox.
That's a hard thing to do.
You're a busy man.
I'm a busy man. Okay, this better not take very long. No, it can take as long as you want.
Tell us what you were just telling us about Drive.
Well, I was saying that it was a very happy... I was happy to be on the record and knew it was going to be brilliant because it was Bela, you know, and the people that were in town at the time were all living in town, and our whole squad for that recording where we were all playing on each other's records with Mark O'Connor and Stuart Duncan and Sam Bush and Edgar Meyer and Mark Schatz and the whole shooting match, you know, Vassar Clements. And there were all these people living in town, and we were always playing together, either at the Station Inn or out on the road or on records together. And then Bela put this Drive concept in front of us. And I couldn't, there was a lot of the sessions that I couldn't make live. I couldn't, because I was on the road with Allison. And I think either Allison or the Whites. I can't remember what year what that was. I think it was before Allison.
88?
That's right, 88. Yeah, way before. Yeah, so I was on the road with the Whites and Pete Rowan and people like that. But I was also going through a divorce. So I was in pieces all the time. And, you know, but Bela was very patient with me. And he knew what I was going through. You know, it's just a bad time for me. But you can't hear it on the record. I mean, it sounds fine. Mm-hmm. And that's partly him, you know, putting things together, you know. I remember it being really, really dark for me. And when the record came out, by the time the record came out, you know, all that stuff was over with and it was all big celebration time and everything. But at the time we cut the record, under the jail. I was feeling so bad, depressed.
So it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, as Charles
Dickens. We cried, we laughed. We mostly cried.
And what was the vibe of the session? What was the general? I guess you weren't in that.
Well, a lot of, I was on some of them. There was one song called Sanctuary.
Right.
That I was there for that one, and it was just Mark O'Connor and Stuart Duncan both playing fiddles and just going wacky, crazy. I mean, they were so good. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys are so good, and I haven't heard anybody even now, you know, come up to that level of what was going on that record. It was just magic, you know. It was like the air, you know, the notes and meeting in the air, that kind of thing in the studio. And we were just having such a good time with each other. We're all such good pals, you know, and there was all this camaraderie, you know, and them helping me through it, you know.
I also remember Jerry was having some kind of an identity crisis at the time. He didn't think he was playing very well, and so he was just feeling kind of very down in the dumps during the session. And we just took our time and made sure he had had the playing he wanted on the record. We didn't rush through it.
When you play, everything goes away. I mean, just getting me in there was hard. It was hard, and I was so depressed. But when I got in there and I started playing, all that stuff was gone. You know, so I imagine that's why the records, my parts sound okay. You can't hear it, but I mean, because it wasn't there when I was playing. But as soon as I would stop playing and go out in the hall or something, it would all hit me all over again. You know, so it was like I could never get a good foothold on it. Bad times. Mm-hmm. But Sanctuary was amazing to me because I was watching these two world, you know, the top of the world fiddlers going at it, and it was just nuts. And and then right at the end of the take, we ran out of tape. We played, the song went on so long that it ran out of tape, and they spliced another piece of tape on the end, and we were recording over another record that I had played on, a Leon Redbone record. And he had just used, you know, just reels, you know, just like 20 reels of tape. And they had, after that, we would just, you know, if they weren't using them, the producer decided they didn't want to even take those tapes with them. So they just left them behind, and Bela got cheap tape. And so we recorded over the Leon Redbone record, the outtakes that he didn't want. So right at the end of Sanctuary, if you really listen, you hear, and it's Leon Redbone. So that's on the record.
That's incredible.
He went ahead and left it, but nobody really knew who it was. We figured that out later. Those two things go together in my mind about Drive, and it was just so funny to hear this cacophony, you know, of these great fiddles and all this stuff, and then they just kind of fade out and you hear
How did you know what you were going to play? Did you get a demo tape? Did you get anything written?
We rehearsed.
You rehearsed.
We rehearsed before the record, and he would oftentimes just come to your house and rehearse one on one with you about parts, you know. And we did that for Drive and Tales from the Acoustic Planet, you know, just about all those Baylor records. And we would work those, a lot of it out, you know, the basic parts of it out before we'd get in the studio and then let the spontaneous stuff happen.
One, two, three, and...
I think the person that was maybe the most mercurial, as he is, you know, has always been in his career, was Tony. Tony wasn't one to spend a lot of time working out arrangements or anything, but he was really quick also. So, you know, once he knew the changes, he was in there. But I think sometimes it hadn't worked up like melodies as well as some of the other guys had. So Bailey just worked around that. He just didn't really give him melodies to play. He would give him a long intro to play or something beautiful, or, you know, take a solo over something like nobody else could.
As Tony was a little bit intimidating for me. I mean, he was the magic in that music. I mean, like, you could take him out of it and it would still be good, but with him there was a magic that came in that was hard to define. The way his guitar danced and it made us all feel when we played, it was glorious to play to, I have to say. But it wasn't perfect. Didn't mean every take was usable. You know, everybody still had to play the song and get all these complicated things together. But I remember every time he would do a solo, he would do one solo and then put the guitar in the case, close the case, and latch the case. And he's the greatest, but there were lots of records out there where I didn't think he was playing that well, probably because he did what he had just done. So I would say, Tony, could you take another pass at that solo, would you mind? And he'd go, what, you want me to take another pass at the solo? I just did one. And I said, yeah, I know. I just want to have a little another shot, if you don't mind, which was very impertinent, but he did it, you know, and I got what I needed, you know. I got him to take a couple passes, so, which we were all doing. It wasn't like we were all like playing it perfect, and then I was singling him out. Like, he was he wasn't concerned because he was such a live player. He wasn't concerned with being perfect or anything like that. But I knew I wanted it to be more than just another Tony Rice recording, because he was on so much stuff. I wanted it to be like where people would go and say, wow, like, that's the Tony Rice, you know, recording you gotta hear.
Tales from Acoustic Planet, because a lot of people kind of, and myself included, see those as two kind of their brethren. They share.
They are related. Tony Rice was playing guitar, and I mean, it's kind of the same group of people, same band. I mean, they both are bluegrass in nature, more acoustic in nature than Deviation. You know, it's but. There was something about Drive that was innocent, you know, that what, like, Tales from the Acoustic Planet is just like, okay, we've got this stuff down. This is what we do. Tony, on that record, Tony Rice was in his phase of he had moved, he had quit driving Lincolns and he'd gone to like the Cobra Mustangs that would go like 500 miles an hour, you know, and he'd go out to his car and listen to Miles Davis and smoke cigarettes in his car and then come back in and we'd do another take of whatever it was we were doing. So he'd just go get in this mindset and he'd come back in and it was the wackiest guitar playing you ever heard. I mean, he just brought it in the room with him, you know, but it was like, you know, okay, we'd finish a take and Tony would just get up and take off and we're just like, okay, well, I guess we can't do anything until he gets back. And Bale was fuming. And, you know, this is taking time. He's got a whole room full of musicians sitting there, but Tony's out in the car listening to Miles Davis.
Influence, are there things that you can point to now and say that's how it influenced the music that came out?
Well, let's look at it for a second. When we think about Drive, at the time it came out, it was pretty forward leaning and pretty complicated for bluegrass music, but with a feel like an old bluegrass band, like the best bluegrass band you ever heard playing this new, slightly new version. But now the people that built on that have taken it to the moon, and some of it I love and some of it I don't, because I think it can be complicated just to be complicated. But that became like a Bible for the people like Chris Thiele's that were coming down the line. That was they could get behind that, and they could get behind the things I was doing outside of bluegrass. People started growing up and they were listening to Drive and Strength in Numbers and going, well, what do we do after that? Well, we, you know, this is cool because it's complicated, this is cool because it's fast, let's go faster, let's go more complicated. I'm not saying everyone should do it like us. I'm just saying we had a pretty good moment going there for a while.
And before we close, I came across an old interview of Baylor, which I think really helps me understand this record even more. Somebody asked him once, do you feel any pressure to constantly break new ground? And his answer was, definitely. It's almost like I made a deal with the banjo when I started playing it, and I really owe it.
Wow.
And I think, to me, that is sort of sums up why he continues to be so groundbreaking in everything he does.
And he has definitely held up his end of that deal.
He has.
Throughout his career.
I think he should cut himself some slack.
Thanks to Jerry Douglas and Mark Schatz and Bela Fleck for taking the time to chat.
And until the next time, goodbye.